Tax Update for Saturday, February the 10th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, February the 10th, 2007. This week, a family affair, spouses, and medical reimbursement plans. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely, so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use included using this podcast or the supporting documents as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This week we're going to look at a pair of cases that came down on Thursday that relate to a concept we discussed about a year ago for medical reimbursement plans for the self-employed individual who employs their spouse and then gets coverage for themselves, both on medical insurance and for general medical expenses. And what we're going to deal with here this week is, while a year ago we dealt with the Speltz case, it was a taxpayer win in a challenge by the IRS to such an arrangement. This week we look at two cases that came down the same day from Minnesota that both dealt with the medical reimbursement plans for a sole proprietor where the taxpayer lost the case, and for two different reasons. So we're going to go through these two cases, take a look at the differences and the issues, and differentiate them from Speltz and indicate what this means for your clients who may be looking at using such plans. Now, this case, we have to remember that back in the Speltz case, to go back and do a little bit of history, you may recall if you look back or go back to that podcast from about a year ago, that the court was very impressed with the records that were kept by the taxpayer in that case and the documentation and the fact they dotted every I, crossed every T. In the two cases we're going to look at today, you're going to find that the taxpayers didn't dot the I's and cross the T's. In fact, they had significant problems and technical problems in their cases. In neither case does the court actually hold that these particular plans didn't work, or should I say, well, they obviously didn't work to get the benefit they wanted, but shall we say could not have worked, or that the facts weren't really there that they worked, but nevertheless, the taxpayer didn't provide the information or have the supporting documentation to show that the plans actually operated properly or that they were entitled to the tax benefits involved, and that became the death knell for these plans. Now, the two cases in question, both were cases that involved taxpayers who had adopted the AgriPlan/BizPlan program that is pushed fairly heavily on the web. You'll see a lot of web coverage of that. You'll see a lot of trade organizations that have links to that plan. I've seen it discussed quite often by tax professionals. Both of these particular cases involve those plans. It is important to note that in neither case did the plan itself come under attack or saying that the documentation or the basic outline didn't work. What came under attack was the actual fact pattern of the taxpayers themselves, but that's crucial because what we have here, I think, is an extension of a problem that we saw on a larger, let's say for the large company scales or the large entity scales or the high income taxpayer scales in the tax shelters in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Now we see the IRS litigating a case that attempts to go after the same sort of off-the-shelf, here's a cookie-cutter tax shelter arrangement that was being marketed to much smaller individuals or smaller businesses. And this may be an indication of the IRS coming down and doing what the commissioner a couple of years ago threatened to do when I was at an AICPA tax division meeting, when he suggested that they were concerned about not only the shelters that have been marketed by the large accounting and law firms to large corporations and high net worth individuals, but we're also worried now about the ones that were down the food chain. And this may be an indication of the IRS pursuit of down the food chain marketed shelters. So let us be aware and be very careful of what we look at here. So what's important is let's go back and understand the basic rationale for a medical reimbursement plan for the sole proprietor. The general rule under Code Section 105B provides that we can exclude from income reimbursements paid by our employer generally for medical expenses that are basically otherwise defined as medical expenses under Section 213. Now, that general rule, as we noted a year ago, is limited by a couple of exceptions, which is why we don't see these plans widespread use in organizations. The first limitation is found in the anti-discrimination provisions in 105H. That makes the plan less than desirable for a business where there are employees other than the immediate family of the owner of the business, because 105H provides, unless we are non-discriminatory and provide this benefit generally in a form, you know, subject to some special anti-discrimination rules, we will find that it will be included in the income of the highly compensated, which, as we recall, highly compensated is defined not just by compensation, by the fact you're related to a significant owner, makes you a highly compensated employee. So 105H is a limitation that means we don't normally see this except in small entities that only employ the immediate family. The second and the key issue looked at in the Speltz case, and the two cases we look at today, is a more general limitation that says that a self-employed individual under 105G, a self-employed individual is not considered an employee. It says, for purposes of this section, the term employee does not include an individual who is an employee within the meaning of section 401(c)(1). Now, that is the section we find the qualified plan provisions that relate to the definition of a self-employed individual being treated as an employee for qualified plan purposes. What this particular provision provides is that you don't get that same benefit when we deal with medical reimbursement plans. Therefore, on the medical reimbursement plan, the self-employed person, meaning the proprietor or the partner in a partnership or the S-corporation shareholder who holds more than 2% of the shares, is not considered an employee and cannot be covered under this plan, doesn't get the exclusion benefit. However, this does not mean that these particular plans cannot be made to work at least for sole proprietors. In Revenue Ruling 71-588, the IRS provided the out for employers in this case. And it's a very short ruling that I've reproduced in the materials, but essentially, in the particular ruling, the taxpayer operated a business as a proprietorship and had several bona fide full-time employees, including his wife. The taxpayer had an accident health plan covering all employees and their families. During 1970, in this example used in the revenue ruling, two employees, including the wife, incurred expenses for medical care for themselves, their spouses, and their children, and were reimbursed pursuant to the plan. The reimbursed amounts qualify as amounts received under accident or health plan for employees within the meanings of 105E of the Internal Revenue Code of 1954 and as amounts described in Section 105B of the Code. Therefore, the IRS holds the reimbursed amounts received by employees are not included in their gross income pursuant to Section 105B, and the amounts are deductible by the taxpayer's business expense under Section 162A. Now, that's good news in a couple of extents. Note, remember, the expenses were paid for the employee, their dependents, and their spouse. Well, if I hire my wife's spouse is me. Therefore, my medical expenses, while they can't be directly paid under the plan, if my spouse is an employee and my spouse is reimbursed for expenses my spouse paid for me, then I can actually get the benefit under my plan that I could not get directly. And even better, it's deductible in computing the income of my entity under Section 162. That means the deduction, as we know, is above the line, but even better, that deduction also counts for purposes of computing self-employment tax. So I get a real major win here by having it structured under this scenario. And the good news is, this is an IRS revenue ruling that still exists today. So there's not a question that this particular strategy works. Now the question becomes, then why do we have these two cases where taxpayers lost this week on these particular issues? We'll get into that particular factor and what goes on, but there are a couple of key issues to note that we're going to have a few restrictions on this coverage. The ruling did not say, which is unfortunately the way many of our clients will read it or read the marketing materials when they go to the websites or their trade organization gives them the quick, dirty marketing summary, that if you are a sole proprietor, you can always just put your spouse on the plan and have reimbursements through your spouse. There are a few requirements to make this go. Let's take a look in more detail at that revenue ruling. We have to do a few things. First, we have to have a bona fide employee spouse. Our spouse has to be a real employee, not just an invented one. You know, it would be nice to know what did the spouse do. Secondly, the spouse does have to be actually reimbursed for the plan. So we have to pretend we actually make reimbursements to the spouse and make sure that the spouse is reimbursed for the expenses. We are reimbursing the spouse's expenses. We're not reimbursing mine. Remember, my expenses cannot be reimbursed. If it turns out that I'm paying my expenses and there's no reimbursements paid, then it would not be a deductible plan. So that becomes a crucial issue. Finally, there's a general rule. Remember, the deduction was allowed under Section 162. Well, Section 162, in allowing a deduction for compensation, has a limitation that's not directly referenced in Revenue Ruling 71-588, but it's still very important. If you take a look at Section 162A1, the allowance for salaries and compensation has a caveat on it, a couple of them. And that is, Section 162 allows us the deduction for ordinary and necessary business expenses, but number one says it includes a reasonable allowance for salaries or other compensation for personal services actually rendered. Two key caveats. The amounts paid must be reasonable for the services provided, and the services must be actually rendered. So to sustain a deduction under Section 162, we have to show that there were real services that took place, and that the amount we paid in compensation, which includes the compensation that represented the medical reimbursement amounts, are reasonable for the benefit received. If that is not a reasonable level of compensation, we lose the deduction and will lose the ability to make use of this particular provision under the code. So that's crucial in making this work. The problem we run into quite often is clients read this, or unsophisticated taxpayers see this as an off-the-shelf cookie-cutter program. And it didn't help in the late 90s and early 2000s that we had all of these large, high-income taxpayers being promoted such cookie-cutter shelters, unfortunately, in a similar setup that were felt to be the ones that could kind of, well, we just go sign these documents, don't worry about what we're doing, but magically your tax goes away. Well, now we have it at a lower level, some clients who happen to believe, or taxpayers that happen to believe, the same sort of situation happens here. We just magically sign two documents and suddenly my income goes down, because I get to take my medical expenses and reduce my business income by that amount. Well, it turns out it's not quite so simple. And what we get into is the danger of off-the-shelf tax planning. Now, as noted, the cases ruled on both dealt with an AgriPlan, BizPlan reimbursement rearrangement. And if you search for that name on Google, you're going to find detailed information on their website about the plan and the situation and the structure they offer and the marketing information on how this works and how it will save you all this money. And you'll also find that many trade organizations link to this information or have information or have arrangements with AgriPlan, BizPlan to set up the plans. Now, the important thing to understand is neither of these cases held that the AgriPlan, BizPlan structure doesn't work. What it held was, if the facts are right, the underlying operation is correct, the underlying facts support it, you still would have a valid medical reimbursement plan. The problem we have in this case is similar to the problem that we had in some of the family limited partnership cases that were pushed under off-the-shelf, turnkey family limited partnership plans, where the taxpayer showed up, documents were signed, and then they were told magically that they had this flip that would solve everything. And as we discovered in the various cases that came down over the years on the family limited partnerships, that doesn't necessarily work. That, in fact, we have some significant problems in the flip areas because of the bad operation. In fact, the easiest way to blow your flip is simply to operate it poorly, because the IRS does not win on the documentation. The IRS wins on the operation of family limited partnerships. We have a similar issue here. The documentation offered by this organization is not the problem. The problem is the reality and the facts on the ground, or the methods and the lack of detail the client kept to document their compliance with the basic requirements to make this plan work. And that became their major problem. The basic idea works. Revenue ruling makes 71-588 makes that clear. And the Speltz case makes it clear that you can sustain such a plan. But we're going to go through these two cases and discover how you could file it up. Now, Snorek versus Commissioner is 2007-34 Tax Court Memo, and Francis versus Commissioner, which is 2007-33 Tax Court Memo, were both issued on Thursday. Both taxpayers reside in Minnesota, and operated businesses there. In the case of Snorrick, Mrs. Snorrick ran an upholstery business. In the case of Francis, Mr. Francis operated a farm. And both of them adopted the plan by the same organization noted above. And as we said, in neither case did that documentation cause us to lose, but we lost for operational problems that ended up being rather interesting and significant. Let's turn first to the Snorrick case, because that was a case where the taxpayer actually got a partial win. You know, part of their expenses were allowed. The problem in Snorrick became a very much a technical issue, but an important one, because we supposedly are reimbursing Mr. Snorrick. Please remember that Mrs. Snorrick ran the upholstery business. Mr. Snorrick, therefore, was the employee whose expenses were being reimbursed. We were supposedly reimbursing Mr. Snorrick, but we could never show that we had reimbursed Mr. Snorrick and that what in fact had not really happened was some of the expenses were just paid by Mrs. Snorrick directly with no reimbursement ever having been done. The key expense in question were the medical insurance premiums. Now, Mrs. Snorrick adopted a plan that provided reimbursement for all health insurance premiums and up to $3,000 in other medical expenses to eligible employees for themselves and their immediate family. Mrs. Snorrick executed an employment agreement with Mr. Snorrick near the end of 2000, where she agreed to pay Mr. Snorrick a whopping $480 a year in wages. Well, you know, he was very highly compensated, and made him an eligible employee under the plan. In 2001, Mr. Snorrick was paid exactly those $480 in wages. He also received benefits under the medical reimbursement plan of $10,355. The key issue is $3,906 of those reimbursed expenses represented premiums paid to Blue Cross Blue Shield under an individual health insurance policy for Mrs. Snorrick. That premium is what became the issue. So let's stop at this point. Remember, all of the other medical reimbursement expenses are allowed. The IRS is not challenging those or challenging their deductibility above the line. The challenge here is solely on the medical premiums paid for Mrs. Snorrick, and the question becomes very simple. The IRS took the position that the Snorricks did not show that Mr. Snorrick actually paid those premiums or that he was actually reimbursed by the business, even if he did. One of those two things had to happen. He had to pay the premiums, and he had to be reimbursed. He was the employee who supposedly incurred the expenses. Well, if he never incurred the expenses or the business never paid him for the expenses that were incurred, then we don't have a deduction. The IRS took the position those premiums were only deductible as allowed under Section 162L. And in the year in question, that was the self-employed health insurance deduction, in that year, it only would allow the 60% of the premium to be deducted above the line. And it also would not count as a deduction against the self-employment tax if that was true, so there's a double whammy there. Now, if you look at this, it appears to be a highly technical violation. The underlying economics didn't change. The Snorricks had paid $3,900 in six. Nobody is questioning that. They're out of pocket for it. Does it really matter if it came out of Mrs. Snorrick's business checking account or not, or whether Mr. Snorrick had written the check? You know, it just, why is this an issue? Well, the tax court said it is an issue. And the tax court held that this very technical violation was enough to invalidate the deduction. It noted they never did prove that he had actually paid the amount. The form of the transaction became important here. This is a case where, in fact, you needed to follow it. Now, as we've discussed in the past on podcasts, substance over form is an interesting concept, but rarely can the taxpayer who's in charge of the form assert it. In this case, again, that would hold true here. The taxpayer really can't argue that, well, you know, hey, we're in the same position, because they clearly are, but it doesn't matter. They were in charge, and remember, we're qualifying this under what's kind of an odd concept to begin with. We're getting something backdoor that we couldn't get directly. We're getting it through a very technical ruling under the law. And what the IRS is saying is, well, if you're going to get it under that technical ruling and that one that really dots with, you know, dotting I's, crossing T's, and reading things very literally, we agree that's allowed, but you better make sure you dot your I's and you cross your T's personally. The Snorrick's failed to do that. For that reason, the Snorrick's lost the deduction for Mrs. Snorrick's health insurance premiums. Now, I suspect that quite a few taxpayers with arrangements like this might have the same problem. taxpayers and married couples rarely are so, you know, nice and neat that they're going to document this perfectly. But it is important to go over with your clients who have a medical reimbursement plan the importance of the SNORAC case, and that if in fact they are paying premiums on a policy for the, on a policy or any other medical expense, it is important to be able to show that the employee spouse paid the expense and that the employer spouse's business issues a reimbursement check. Yes, that is shuffling money for apparently no reason, but that shuffling of checks and that exchanging of checks and deposits of checks is important to make your medical reimbursement plan work under this ruling. I would strongly suggest that clients be told, look, you're playing something here that is very, very much a technical game. It clearly works, but the IRS is indicating that they are going to be very picky about how you operate this, and the SNORAC case is a good example. Now, the next case, while the SNORACs were able to preserve most of the deduction, the other taxpayer who had their case come down that day wasn't so lucky. The case of Francis versus Commissioner deals with essentially the same issue, or very similar to the IRS template to litigate in the Speltz case. Was there a legitimate employment relationship between the two spouses, and were payments to that spouse, including medical reimbursement plans, reasonable compensation? In this particular case, despite the court's misgivings over how the IRS was arguing this in some ways, the IRS succeeded in eliminating the medical benefit. Now, Mr. Francis had operated a farm for 40 years as a sole proprietorship, and the court noted that Mrs. Francis, over those years, had assisted Mr. Francis by performing various farming chores since he began operating the farm, although she had not generally received compensation for such work until the medical reimbursement plan came into play. Mr. Francis adopted a medical reimbursement plan in 1991 that allowed health insurance costs to be paid for eligible employees and to be additionally reimbursed for up to $8,000 of other medical expenses. Now, the court notes that 1991 date, but for whatever reason, it's not till 1997 that Mrs. Francis actually comes into the plan. And in that year, she signed an employment agreement with Mr. Francis. She would keep the farm's books, run business errands, and answer telephone calls. She'd receive an annual salary of $2,004, interesting number, and would participate in the medical reimbursement plan. However, the agreement did not have any statement about how many hours she would work, nor did it establish the days or times when she would be available for work. In the year in question, she performed services for the farm, though there was no documentation of how many hours she had worked, nor was there any documentation of exactly what she had done. All we know is she got a check for $1,998 in wages. The court did note a set of facts that it seemed significant in deciding the reality of this arrangement. And the court made a notation here that was interesting, that in addition to doing this, Mrs. Francis also ran errands for her son's farm in 2001. But the court noted her son didn't treat her as an employee and didn't pay her a salary. Also note that the taxpayer's son also performed services for his father's farm, and he wasn't treated as an employee of the farm. So there were all these arrangements where nobody was being compensated for these services except for Mrs. Francis in this limited arrangement. Now, she was reimbursed $9,502 for the year in question, with $5,571 being paid on a joint health insurance policy issued by Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and a Medicare supplement for Mr. Francis. Thus, her total compensation, considering both her wages and her medical reimbursement, was $11,500, and the entire amount, both the regular salary and the medical reimbursement amount, were deducted on Schedule F by Mr. Francis. Now, the tax court's key concern is telegraphed early on in its opinion. It recites the standard line that we find about deductions are a matter of legislative grace, but then goes on to note the taxpayer must show he or she is entitled to any deduction claimed. That includes the burden of substantiation. And the key issue here is going to be to prove that, in fact, we have given proper substantiation to the matter in question. The first key issue was whether Mrs. Francis truly was an employee. And the court indicated they had some issue about her employment arrangement and said, you know, there were some concerns they had. The deductibility, as I said, employee benefit plan generally requires proof of an employer-employee relationship. The IRS conceded Mr. Francis had the right to control Mrs. Francis in her in her performance of service on the farm, but also points to several factual inconsistencies that discredit her characterization as an employee. Specifically, she performed services for the farm for many years before 1997. She performed services for her son's farming operation without being treated as an employee of his operation, and the son performed services on the farm without being treated as an employee of mom and dad. These situations all combined to suggest that maybe she was an employee only because it looked convenient to claim she was one. But the court was decided not to worry as much about that issue. It said, I don't need to decide that because there's another issue that's going to overcome this. The court specifically stated one of their footnote issues in noting they would not decide this was that while they thought those facts were troubling and whether she really was an employee, it noted equally troubling is the IRS's argument that no bona fide employee-employer relationship existed, yet the IRS conceded that basically taxpayers were entitled to deduct 1998 wages paid to Mrs. Francis. And the court's a little concerned about this inconsistency. You concede the wage payments allowed, but you're arguing she's not an employee. You know, why were the wages conceded if that's your position? So it went on and said, but even assuming that she was a bona fide employee, they find that basically the taxpayers failed to prove any compensation paid to her in excess of 1998 was reasonable. Any amount given the petition that the taxpayers had failed to document the hours or times she worked on the farm. She may perform services for the farm. Now, analyze the point using basically the following summary analysis. It said basically whether amounts paid are reasonable is a question of fact that will be determined by the facts and circumstances. And it went on to determine whether hers were reasonable. It noted that their employment agreement did not set the number of hours she was required to work to earn her pay or benefits, nor did Mrs. Francis keep a time log recording the number of hours she worked. They didn't establish what Mrs. Francis earned on an hourly basis because they didn't prove how many hours she worked. They did not establish what employees doing comparable work on similarly sized farms were paid hourly. Therefore, the court held, essentially, there is no proof here that the compensation in question was reasonable. Under Section 162A1, that compensation, or to be deductible, must be shown to be reasonable. The taxpayer failed to show that, and for that reason, the medical reimbursements amounts were disallowed. Now, what does this tell us? Well, both of these cases tell us it's important to note that neither one of these are a reversal of Revenue Ruling 71-588. It is not the case to go down the sky is falling and these cases never work. Speltz is correct. All three of these cases arguably are correctly decided. The issue is not, and they are easy to reconcile with each other. Rather, what it does show is that you can't just adopt this as an off-the-shelf cookie-cutter approach to tax planning. This is not handed to the client, sign this document, and then we can forget, and we'll just tell me what your medical expenses were, and we'll put them on Schedule C. Taxpayers need to follow the terms of the plan. Taxpayers need to actually reimburse the medical expenses in question and document that the employee spouse is the one that paid them. Taxpayers need to document what the employee spouse did and document the reasonability of the compensation being paid to the employee spouse in order to justify the deduction for the medical expenses and get the benefits thereafter. What you probably should do is review with your clients who claim to have such a plan the implications of these cases, what they need to do to make them legal, and also why it is not just as simple as they may believe to go down and what they were told by somebody else is, oh, I just signed this document and magically everything happens. Also, it's important for tax practitioners to be aware this is a very, very good cautionary statement about the dangers of using cookie-cutter, mass-marketed, I'm going to use a one-size-fit-all tax plan. Unfortunately, I've seen that marketed at all levels of practice, from the very small firm all the way up to the largest entities, want to make use of that. It is very, very tempting for a firm to be able to do that because you can take a basic tax plan, you can reproduce it, do it for everybody, and just keep handing it out. The problem becomes that unless you go over with clients in detail what has to be done to make this good, rather than just look at this as sort of a revenue maximization proposal where we do the same thing as cookie cutter and we're just handing it out, and we just tell, you know, and all the members of the firm are just handed this and said, go market it. That doesn't work. Tax planning is an individualized process. Tax procedures, tax plans, tax strategies have to be handled on an individual basis, and you do have to worry about dotting I's and crossing T's, and that's where we run into problems where we try to market plans like this. There is nothing fundamentally wrong with this plan, just as there's nothing fundamentally wrong with many of the family limited partnership documents that were mass marketed. The fundamental problem is, regardless of how good that documentation may be or the theory may be, the actual practical application and operation of the arrangement is what's going to determine whether it works or not. That becomes the crucial issue. Now, I also wanted to go on to one other little issue this week, because I've been working with for a while, as many of you may be aware, that Microsoft released at the end of January, Vista and Office 2007. So let's have a little tech talk here for a second. I have been running for ever since essentially the day of release, or day immediately after the consumer release, Vista and Office 2007. Well, I need to rephrase that. I have been running Office 2007 pretty heavily. Vista, I have not run as much as I would run others. In fact, my normal work when I'm working in the Windows environment is under XP. And I suppose I better explain that for a moment. The machine in question that I'm running everything on is, as some of you are aware, an Apple MacBook that is running OS X as its base operating system. However, I am using virtual machine technology provided by Parallels. And I should note, virtual machine technology is important here because I think it may be an issue you need to get used to, because we'll probably be using it in other arrangements even if you never come near an Apple computer. Virtual machine technology, for a reason we'll discuss here, could still be very, very important for legacy applications. And that's true even on a machine that is a pure Windows platform. And by the way, Parallels sells Windows versions, and VMware is a much better known Windows version, a virtual machine that runs Windows on Windows platforms quite often, as well as Microsoft's own virtual PC. We run that, so on this particular machine, running on the virtual machines, I have two virtual machines installed, one of which is running Windows XP, and one of which is running Vista. And I have both machines in play for a reason, because we'll get into why I need both the XP machine and the Vista machine. So right now, I am running Vista XP and OS X on this particular machine. Let's talk first about Vista. And there's some very good things about Vista. And to be honest, I would love to be able to run Vista as my primary operating system, but we'll get back to a second as to why I really can't run Vista as my primary Windows operating system and why I have had to drop back to running XP as the primary. Vista has some interesting changes. We all know about the Aero Glass. Perhaps you've heard about the fancy and the pretty, and we've heard the wow instance, and we'll ignore all that stuff. Let's concentrate on what makes some differences in the business world. One huge difference with Vista is Microsoft has become much more concerned about security. Now, this is also the thing that causes people the most headaches in Vista, at least initially, on top. Well, the next thing I'll talk about causes more headaches ultimately when you try to do it, but this is the first one people notice. There is in security now, we have been introduced to the concept of user access control, or UAC. What's user access control? Whenever a program tries to do something dangerous, even if you are running as administrator, you're going to get a basic stop in the system, and a box is going to pop up, and you have to take action. When something is going to do something dangerous, you need to basically give it clearance to go forward and do it. And everything will stop and halt. It's a very different notice when those issues come up under Vista. Now, many Windows users are complaining about UAC, claiming it interrupts them too often. My complaint is probably just the opposite. Microsoft toned it down. In original implementations, when this box came up, you would have to type your administrator password to get by the UAC box every time it came up. So you would have to authorize and give your password to authorize the operation. Microsoft has disabled that requirement or removed that requirement for the administrator account, and that is still in the default install of Windows Vista. The default account that we get is an administrator account. Why is that a problem? Well, it becomes very easy to do what we all know Windows users love to do, click on, keep clicking until everything goes away. Windows users won't have to stop and think. They can just click and get rapidly by these particular buttons. In fact, I heard a commentary that Symantec was thinking of providing a program that would do the clicks automatically for you so you didn't have to think about it. That's wonderful. Not. In other modern operating systems that are based on Unix, you always have to give your full password every time this comes up. Why is it, you know, people who use OS X or people who use Linux, I run a Linux server, and when I do something and a program goes for install, I'm given my admin password to get things to go. In OS X, when I go to install a program, I give my admin password to allow that to happen. Why does this not considered such a huge problem? Well, two reasons. Number one, OS X and Linux users are used to it. We know it happens. Number two, the programs we use know they're going to be asked. They don't just presume they can go run off and do things. So they are less apt to trigger the box. They trigger it rarely, only when they absolutely need to. Old Windows apps play fast and loose and do things basically presuming they have full run of the machine regardless and try to take privileges they don't really need or do things they don't really need to do simply because they've always been able to do so. That means that you'll see UAC boxes more often under Windows than you would under OS X and Linux simply because programs that kept popping those boxes up under Linux or OS X are simply programs nobody would use. Doesn't do much good if you don't have a program you can sell. So for that reason, UAC is going to become more of an issue, but I think over time it'll drop back. My concern, though, is that as people get used to it, they will see that it's just one more box to click by in Windows, and the initial gain we're going to get in security from UAC is going to go away over time as users just get tired, just basically get used to clicking by the box and don't pay any attention to what's going on. Windows still fundamentally suffers from the flaw that essentially it's quick, easy, and dirty, and Microsoft caved at the end. I would have preferred they'd done one of two things. A, I would have strongly preferred had they defaulted to not an admin account as the default account on the machine. If they would have forced you to establish a non-admin account and forced you to establish an administrator password. That would have at least made it simpler, and so users could still work their way back up to admin, but the average user out of the box would have a less enabled account. I should add that under Vista, you actually can run as something other than administrator, and the system works. Those of you who used XP know that if you ever tried to run on a limited user account, you quickly discovered programs that simply would not run, even if you used the run as option, they still wouldn't run properly. If unless you came up as full admin on the system. Under Vista, you can actually run as a limited user account. To a certain extent, that's because even the admin account has certain things stopped and held, so the program's going to have to play a little more by the rules. Now, this brings us to the number two key issue, and perhaps my big problem with Vista and why I'm not running Vista. Vista is wonderful. Vista is great. It runs Office. It runs all kinds of things, you know, basically that I want to run. Well, let me back off for a second. OS X on the Macintosh is great. It's wonderful. It's very secure. It runs 95% of what I need to run. It runs Office. It runs Word, Excel, the Macintosh versions of those, fully compatible to Windows versions. Why can't I use OS X as my primary operating system or my only operating system? Because CCH, Pro System FX, does not run under OS X. Now let's visit Vista. Vista is wonderful. Vista is great. Vista runs Office, Word, Excel, all those neat things. It runs 95% of what I need to run, but it doesn't run CCH, Pro System FX. So the problem right now is that Vista and OS X are basically give me the same issue and the same problem. Now, over the year, CCH has said they are going to fix, and they basically have to, the problems they have with Vista. However, I would note that a lot of legacy software never will fix those problems. So if you are relying on legacy software, Vista is going to require you to either convert that software over if there is never going to be a Vista-compatible version, or this is where virtual machines may help you, which is run virtual machine technology and basically keep an XP machine around running under your Vista machine. or run the XP machine as the base, run Vista and the virtual machine under it, to allow you to run those programs that you can't run under Vista. Right now, I have Vista installed on the MacBook, but I'm running XP, so when I need to use CCH, I switch over to the XP machine. I can actually run Vista and XP concurrently on the MacBook along with OS X. That is just as doable on an off-the-shelf Dell. What you'd have to do, get 2 gigabytes or more of RAM, load up as much RAM as you can, because virtual machines need RAM. And I could have both operating systems running. What I'm saying is, even as we finally get to the point where all of our current programs will work fine with Vista, old programs weren't. Why is that also important? Intuit has announced that previous versions of much of their software is not Vista compatible and will not be Vista compatible. Now, that's fine and good if you're operating that. The problem we have in accounting firms, though, is that quite often we have clients who are on the old equipment, the old machines, and are sending in the old information, and we may need to support them on that particular platform. That means it may be very, very important to learn about virtual machine technology so you can keep a virtual XP machine around to run the old software that doesn't work. So Vista is an issue that way. Office 2007 I've been running also during that period. Now, Office 2007, I run primarily Word and Excel. There are major changes in both. These two programs look very different than they did before. The menu is gone. There is no menu. What is there is the ribbon. And the ribbon has the items that generally were in the menu, but they're not necessarily where you expect them to be. In fact, one of the most useful things you can find is a particular cheat sheet that I got from the Mr. Excel website, www.mrexcel.com. You can actually subscribe. Bill Jelen runs a daily video podcast that goes over tips and tricks for working with Excel. And if you work with Excel quite a bit, and he's currently going over Excel 97 to 2003 and Excel 2007 in many of his issues, you will find that you can pick up a lot of useful tips from him. Well, he has produced a cheat sheet that also is very useful to go from Excel 2003's menus to where things are in the ribbon in Excel 2007. He also has a book that does the same sort of transition for you to try to get Excel 2007 up to speed. But it is important. Things are there. It is a shock when you first open it up, and it definitely initially slows you down if you're used to the menu system. However, having worked with it now for a couple of weeks, I can say that once you get used to it, it is a much more efficient system. The problem we're going to have is how many people are going to get past that initial shock and actually learn to work with it. Let's go over some of the changes, though. Besides the ribbon and the interface, which is the most shocking change you're going to hit, the file format has changed. Now, that's important because you're going to start to receive emails now, and you're going to start to receive documents from clients that are in the newer Excel format and the newer Word format. Now, I'm going to take an aside here for a second. Practical matter is, we shouldn't be sending document files ever via email or Excel spreadsheets ever via email unless the recipient has some reason to change it. The problem is Microsoft made it so easy to do the send option from the menu to email the document in its standard format. The reason they did that, let's be blunt, it was to help secure the fact that Office would be the standard, basically, word processing and spreadsheet format. And by having those things emailed, the presumption became everybody has to own basically Word and Excel. Well, that's great. It helped build Microsoft's market share. It protected them. But it does one other big problem. It also introduces a real vector for sending malware, and especially targeted malware. If I want to get something in your system, and that's becoming in vogue now, there are reasons why I want your system, because you happen to be a CPA firm and you have lots of ID numbers and other information I'd love to get access to. So if I can get one inside your system, get the malware in there, I can do some real work, and these offer the perfect vector. What we have seen recently, we are seeing many, many fewer problems now at the base operating system. Microsoft has begun to plug enough things that actually Vista is very secure. We're starting to see a lot better security in Internet Explorer 7. We're seeing a lot better security in the base operating system with the patches, even on XP. But the problem becomes, now they made that more difficult, we're now seeing a back-to-the-future approach, and the most recent exploits we've seen in recent months, now we're going back to macro exploits on Word and Excel. Basically, Microsoft Office macro exploits are coming into vogue again. Security holes tend to go this way. We go to where the weakest link is, and now the weakest link is becoming the macro languages in office, are the weak link. And that is where the virus writers are aiming right now. So for that reason, you need to be aware that accepting doc files and accepting XLS files and having people blindly open those is a extremely dangerous practice. I would suggest that your staff needs to be made aware that you should never, never, never open a document or an Excel file without knowing that you should be receiving it. Even better, I'll be honest, you want to be safe, and people will be upset with you, and you know, people won't be happy, your staff may be upset, but you want to be safe, you want to protect your system, I would strongly suggest go get the OpenOffice product, not because you're going to use it, but if you go to OpenOffice.org, download it, and link that up as your default for your email client for opening attachments for doc files and XLS files. That will save you the problem because they won't generally run the macros. So therefore, the macro viruses won't work. Therefore, that's a much safer way to view those documents. Now, that added, Word and Excel now in 2007, you'll also note that many of the exploits now don't work on 2007. Why? 2007 has become, paranoid about viruses and paranoid about executing macros. And you're going to find 2007 will bug you a lot about any document that contains a macro. In fact, this may cause you problems with some of the things you're used to using in your firm or in your organization, because 2007 has some really interesting ideas about where it might be safe to open a document from, and more importantly, where it's not safe. And the presumption is generally it's not a safe place it came from. So your users will see a lot of things pop up for macros. For instance, I have a function macro in Excel that is testing for essentially whether there is a, for conditional formatting purposes, whether there is a formula in a cell or not. That particular macro, when I try to load that sheet from certain locations, even locations on my own local network, Excel 2007 is concerned it may be coming from an unsafe location. I had to go back in and specifically add that location as safe in its list of safe locations. Excel 2007 has a very narrow list of safe places that it considers safe to get macro-enabled information. And if it didn't come from there, Excel 2007 will treat it as no good. Or basically will automatically pop up a dialog box, pop up a little bar at the top, much like the bar you see in Internet Explorer when you hit an ActiveX control it doesn't want to load. And you'll get that little bar where you have to click to allow the macro to run. And every time I loaded a spreadsheet with a particular function in it, I had to click to get it to go until I had made the areas those spreadsheets came from safe areas as far as Excel 2007 is concerned. So that's in there as well. Now, the one neat thing there is in Excel 2007, there is a really, really useful table feature. The table feature, including table functions, can help dramatically with consistency of spreadsheet structure. If you take a look at Excel 2007, take a look at the table formula structure. The bad news is you have to save in the new Excel file format and have to be outside compatibility mode, essentially, saving in the regular Excel file format, the new Excel file format, to have these work. They are great at enforcing consistency. Unfortunately, when it goes back to Excel 97 to 2003 format, you go back to the standard formulas. But it is a great new feature. It's something to take a look at and get used to. Overall, I like Office 2007. If you save in the old file format, you'll lose some of the features, but you can still work with your old Office mates, and you're probably going to need to roll this thing forward anyway because you're going to start receiving documents in the format. While Microsoft has compatibility plug-in for older versions of Word, basically for Word 2007, for Word 2000 and forward, and for Excel 2000 and forward, you're probably going to eventually have to make this conversion, so get used to it for your office. Vista, honestly, you need to avoid Vista for now, probably in most organizations, certainly if you're in tax season, a CPA firm, because it's highly likely that there's something incompatible you're going to have to solve. It is important maybe to go out and get Vista to find out about that incompatibility, but you need to understand that's coming forward. Finally, consider virtual machine technology. You may very well need to get used to that, or at least have that in the background in your toolkit, because I do expect there's going to be, for almost every one of us, some legacy application we need to have access to for some reason that will not be Vista compatible. And for that reason, it will probably be best if we can keep a virtual machine running that will be able to run XP. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, February the 10th, 2007. Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. They have information of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.